Just one day after Jack McLennan's relationship fell apart, he vanished.
I couldn't believe this was happening.
Immediately, accusations started flying.
You need to cough up and you need to confess.
But it soon became clear there was so much more to the story.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
You know where my son is.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Ten police went to arrest Desi Freeman for child sexual abuse in August last year. Only eight of them left. What happened that morning in remote northern Victoria has haunted police and the community for months, and it will now be examined at the coronial inquest. I'm Stephen Stockwell, and a content warning for this episode, we're going to be describing some distressing scenes and repeating some offensive language. Welcome to The Case Of.
Police were serving a search warrant as part of a sex crime investigation when Freeman opened fire.
Killing a 59-year-old detective and 35-year-old senior constable.
Mr. Freeman is a so-called sovereign citizen who believe the government and the courts are illegitimate.
The two officers were gunned down in Port Punca, their names now etched in Victoria Police's honour wall.
On Tuesday, we took you inside the coroner's court to look at the final moments of Desi Freeman. But that story started months before his death. The moments that led to that shooting started when he shot and killed two police officers, Vadim Davard-Hoddart and Neil Thompson. On the ground in Port Punca after that happened and following along with the inquest is Ashley Aldridge, a reporter at ABC Goulburn Murray. Ashley, thank you for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
The detail of this shooting is horrific. There's a number of police going out to the bus that Freeman was living in. They're there to execute a search warrant. They gain entry to the bus that he was in, and that's when he opens fire.
Yeah, that's right. Horrific is probably the best way to describe it. We heard yesterday that once the police gained entry into that bus, after about 34 minutes of trying to negotiate with Freeman to get him to come out of that bus, they eventually gained access. And it was then that detective leading senior constable Neil Thompson was shot and fell to the ground immediately. And then the other police that were in the annex at the time, they turned to run. And we heard that senior constable Vadim Davard-Hoddart was at that point shot as well.
Yeah, Ash, it is such a dramatic scene. And I mean, I didn't know too many of the details surrounding this. And something I'd always wondered about in this shooting was how prepared police were heading to Freeman's property. I just had questions about how many people there were, what planning was done. But, you know, it did seem like they were quite well organised.
Yeah, that's right. So we've learned that there were several units involved in that warrant execution on the day, that being members of the Wangaratta Criminal Investigation Unit, which Detective Thompson was part of, members of the Wangaratta Child Sex Offences Unit, and that was because the warrant that they were there to execute was in relation to the sexual assault of a minor, and also uniform officers from the Bright Police Station, which is where Senior Constable Davard-Hoddart was on secondment from Melbourne at. Now, we know that they met at the Bright Police Station, so many of those officers have travelled from Wangaratta. For people that aren't familiar with the area, that's about a 40-minute drive, so they've travelled from Wangaratta to Bright, met at the police station there for a briefing, and then they've travelled by convoy to the property at Port Punca. And again, for those unfamiliar with the area, it's about a 10-minute drive back from Bright to Port Punca toward Wangaratta.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Ash. And I mean, we've got details of the number of officers involved, I think 10 officers involved in total, and also some more details of Freeman's alleged offending as well. I mean, you've mentioned that the Wangaratta Child Sexual Offence Unit is part of this group executing this warrant. The warrant was to search the property for child abuse material. And am I right in thinking this started because there was a disclosure from a child of a sexual assault by Freeman?
Yeah, so in the days following the shooting, we had heard a few details about why police were there and details around that warrant. But yesterday we really got some more finer details. And as you mentioned, that was including that in June of last year, police received a disclosure in respect to an alleged sexual assault involving a child under the age of 16, as well as an attempt to involve a child in the production of child abuse material. So the purpose of that search warrant was to find and seize any electronic devices that were to be interrogated for the potential presence of child abuse material. And while they were there, they also planned to arrest and interview Freeman as part of that investigation.
Yeah, and that's the reason, yeah, everyone is at this property. You know, the scene that you started us with, talking about police entering the bus that Freeman was living in, that was after they'd been at the property for about half an hour or so. What happened when police arrived in the first instance?
Yeah, so police arrive at Rayner Track that the property is on in a convoy. Now, again, for context, I've been up that track. It's quite narrow and the property sits at the very end of the track and the driveway has an electronic gate. Now, when those police officers have arrived, that gate was locked. So a decision was made for five of the officers to go into the property on foot, while another three took a police vehicle and they accessed the property via a nearby lane. Two other police stayed with the car at the front of the driveway at the gate. Now, as the five officers made their way to that bus where the Freemans were living, they saw his wife, Amalia. She went back into the annex and then the police have followed her and they've knocked on the bus door to say why they were there. And at that point, they could see Freeman, his wife, and they could also hear a young child in the bus.
This isn't a property that Desi Freeman owns, though, is it? He's living in this bus. There's a caravan there. The guy who owns the property, I think, actually wanders down at one point filming the police on his phone.
Yeah, that's right. So they're living on the property of Andrew Swift. They'd been there for several years. And you're correct. Once police arrived there, Andrew Swift comes down to the bus and he actually says to the police that they were trespassing on private property and he starts filming on his phone. Now, this vision makes up a large amount of video evidence that was captured from the incident. We heard from council assisting that along with Mr. Swift's mobile vision, there was also another person there filming on their phone and five of those police officers were also wearing body-worn cameras.
Yeah, so there's going to be a lot for the coroner to basically watch to see how that unfolded. And I mean, as we discussed in our episode on Tuesday, it's, you know, the reverse of the situation in Tollagalong where, you know, none of the special operations group officers were wearing body cameras and the only footage from that is from the helicopter. Doesn't sound like Desi Freeman is particularly cooperative, doesn't sound like his wife is particularly cooperative, doesn't sound like Andrew Swift, who owns this property, is, you know, kind of assisting this situation in any way. Why weren't they cooperating?
Well, when Freeman is told by police why they're there and what the warrant is about, and that is it's in fact in regards to child sex offences, he describes it as bullshit. He argues with the police. He refuses to come out. He tells them that they can go to hell, that the search is illegal and that he doesn't recognise their law. At one stage, he said that he was going to appeal that search warrant in the Supreme Court during some of that back and forth.
Yeah, that really stuck out to me. Can you do that?
I'm really not sure if you can, but we do know that Freeman already had quite a fractured relationship with the law before August last year. So in 2021, he was involved in an attempt to have the former Victorian Premier Daniel Andrews tried for treason and fraud. 3 years later, he told the Supreme Court that he and his family were the victims of malicious prosecution and a personal vendetta after he was stopped for speeding out the front of a fish and chip shop. So it is certainly a method that he has used before.
Okay. I mean, I think, you know, fractured relationship with the law is an interesting way to describe Freeman. We should flag that he has actually changed his name. He was originally known as Desmond Philby. Council assisting mentioned this at the start of the hearing earlier this week. I mean, Ash, there is this back and forth with Freeman, his wife and Andrew Swift and the police, you know, not letting police onto the bus that he was living in. How do they end up getting in?
Yeah, so we heard that they made multiple attempts to coax the Freemans out. Desi refused. At one stage, a police officer went onto the roof of the bus to try to get in, and that was unsuccessful. And after about half an hour, the police called a supervisor to get permission to essentially break into the bus. That was granted, and it was at that point that Detective Thompson was able to remove a perspex piece of glass that was at the top of the bus door. So he was able to get that glass off and then enter the bus feet first. And it's as he enters into the bus, when his body goes in, that he is shot in the side of the face. And we heard from the counsel assisting that at that point he immediately collapses. Then there was one officer standing directly behind Detective Thompson, and he has yelled "gun" and ran. And behind him was Senior Constable Devart Hotart, who had also turned to run, but Freeman fired a second time, hitting him.
Yeah, the police at this point, you know, as you've described, you know, are kind of running. You've got the officer who's behind Detective Thompson running away. Senior Constable Devart Hotart has been shot. You know, you've got police hiding behind a car, a shed. What does Freeman do at this point?
So Freeman is actually captured on body-worn camera at this point, repeatedly saying, "I had no choice, I had no choice." Then we hear a short time later, Freeman actually comes out of the bus with the shotgun that he had used to shoot the two police officers. He goes over to Senior Constable Devart Hotart and removes his gun from his holster and a spare magazine. And then he continues to shoot at the officers that are taking cover. The court then heard that a police officer actually yelled out, "Can you hear us, Tomo?" Now, that was toward Detective Thompson. And at that point, Freeman was heard yelling, now a language warning here, "Die in hell, you fucking scum, die in fucking hell," as he stood over the body of Detective Thompson. He has then used Senior Constable Devart Hotart's gun to shoot Detective Thompson a second time.
Something that stood out to me, Ash, from this part of the opening was that counsel assisting didn't want to repeat some of the things that Desi Freeman was saying inside the truck, because we had family members of the police officers watching along.
Yeah, that's right. He really made a point when he was reading out the opening that he wasn't going to repeat what Freeman said when he stood over the bodies of those two police officers, out of respect, because we know that Detective Thompson's sisters and partner were in court, and the parents of Senior Constable Devart Hotart were on a link from Belgium watching on. So I guess it's fair to say that that is some indication of what was said at that time.
Yeah, and the coroner and counsel assisting made points at various parts of the hearing earlier this week to highlight the, you know, the trauma that the families of these officers would still be dealing with, you know, and the role the media has in kind of, you know, portraying these stories sensitively and, you know, not causing any further harm to them as well. Ash, how much of this detail was new to you?
Freeman's actions after the initial shooting of the two police officers were certainly new details that we hadn't heard before. We knew that he had taken one of the officers' guns in those early reports from police when it was still quite unfolding on that day. We were getting information that he was armed and had potentially taken a police officer's gun, but we certainly didn't know that he had used that gun to shoot Detective Thompson a second time. We also didn't know about a fourth officer being injured in the shooting while taking cover. So they were seeking cover behind a white van, and they received cuts to their face, their ear and their neck from shattered pieces of glass. So that was certainly some new information that also came out of that hearing.
Yeah, because, I mean, the scene that you've just talked us through, the shooting of Senior Constable Devart Hodart and Detective Thompson, and, yeah, the scene you're describing here is this kind of shooting that continues after that initial exchange.
Yeah, that's right. And that is when the third officer that was critically injured was shot in the leg. So we know he was also seeking cover and was critically injured. He was taken by ambulance from the scene after this unfolded and taken to nearby Myrtleford, which is the closest next big town. And he was actually taken by helicopter to Melbourne with those serious injuries.
Yeah. Where does Desi Freeman end up?
So Desi Freeman was last seen walking into the bushland. Police did fire back. I think it was two shots were fired back at him, but he did manage to flee into that thick bushland that goes into the Mount Buffalo National Park.
And he sent a message to his partner, I think, basically saying, take the kids and I think was it, I'll see you in heaven.
Yeah, that's right. We had heard that he had perhaps sent a text message, but we didn't have it confirmed, but that certainly came out in the hearing that he had sent that message encouraging her to keep going and that he would see her in heaven.
Yeah. Other police arrive at Freeman's property around 11 o'clock in the morning, kind of obviously back up after this, you know, shooting has taken place. When did you end up in Porepunkah?
So I actually went back through my phone records and I got a phone call from a contact in the area at 10:30. After hearing the evidence from counsel assisting, I assume that this contact has seen that initial convoy of police going from Bright to Porepunkah. So they've seen that and they've called and they've just said to me, hey, Ash, you know, seems to be a lot of police in the Bright area. Not sure what's going on. Maybe it's, you know, something I just thought I would let you know, but there seems to be an unusual amount of police here. So I sort of jumped off the phone and I had a quick chat to my acting editor and then I called some other contacts. No one really knew much. And then I called a police station and the response I got from them was they couldn't tell me anything, but I got a feeling that things were a bit frantic, which is unusual when I usually call them. Mm. So it was enough for me to sort of, you know, my journo gut to go, okay, there might be something happening. So I sort of packed up the gear. I'm a video journalist, so I packed up my camera and we made the decision that I would just go and see what was happening. It's about an hour drive. So I think I got there just after about 11:30, but on my drive there, I was actually being passed by police with their lights and sirens going because they were coming from Wodonga as well. So when I did get there, it was quite chaotic. There was police everywhere. I got out of the car and two police officers sort of ran at me and were telling me to leave, to get out of there. It wasn't the time to be filming because I got my phone out and immediately started filming. And then once I sort of explained to them who I was and that I was from the media, they were a bit more receptive. Yeah. So I was there pretty early on in the incident.
Yeah, it would have been just incredibly confronting being in a situation like that with what I can imagine were police that were pretty frustrated that there was anybody in the way at all as they were trying to work out what had happened and track down Desi Freeman. I mean, when you were listening to the evidence on Monday, you know, did you find yourself reflecting and having more of an understanding of what they were dealing with at the time?
Yeah, I could see when I got there and the two police officers that first approached me, and my colleagues weren't that far behind me, so I wasn't there by myself for too long. And as you can imagine, like, the media really started to roll in. But I could see that one of the police officers, and I actually know her, I've been covering this area for 10 years, so like, she was familiar to me, but I could see that she was visibly upset. At the time, I had no idea what was going on because it was still so early, but I guess it was enough for me to know that it was something serious. And by that point, the air wing had arrived as well and it was hovering really low over the paddock, not far from where I was. And then the dog squad arrived as well.
Something that stuck out to me, Ash, in the hearing on Monday was the detail we got about the weapons that were used in this shooting. I mean, we've talked about a shotgun that Desi Freeman had. Was, you know, the guns used something that was a new bit of detail in this story?
Yeah, so again, we'd heard bits and pieces about the shotgun that was initially used and then Freeman taking the police officer's handgun, but this was the first time that we'd really got detailed information about this as well. So we heard that Freeman was first licensed for rifles and shotguns back in 2015 and handguns in 2016. Those licenses, though, were suspended and reinstated several times over the years. But on August 26 last year, all of Freeman's firearm licenses had expired while suspended. So that means he no longer legally held a firearms license and had no guns registered to his name. Police, we did hear during that hearing that police still don't know where the shotgun used in the incident came from, and the weapon still hasn't been recovered.
Yep. Okay. Ash, something that happened towards the end of the hearing on Monday was the appointment of a coronial investigator. What is that person going to do?
Yeah, so the job of the coronial investigator, the best way probably to describe it is sort of they do the boots on the ground part of the investigation. Sort of if we think along the lines of examining the scene, gathering evidence, liaising with families of the deceased, reporting back to the coroner with what is known as that coronial brief of evidence. Mm-hmm. So we heard that Senior Sergeant Nigel Lestrange from the Victoria Police Homicide Squad has been appointed to this coronial inquest. And now this investigation is being oversighted by the Victoria Police Professional Standards Command.
Yeah, okay. And as we talked about in our episode on Tuesday, you know, the coronial process is not about kind of working out if there's criminal charges that will be laid on anyone or, you know, kind of apportioning damages for anything that has occurred. It's just looking into the circumstances of the death and, you know, if anything could be prevented in future. That being said, though, Desi Freeman was wanted for criminal charges. He was wanted for child sexual offences. Do we hear anything more about the charges he was facing or what evidence was recovered from his house?
No, we only heard about the warrant during that hearing. We didn't hear any further details, but the ABC did reveal last month that police were at that property to execute a warrant for his devices on which hundreds of files containing child abuse material were later found. Now, detectives discovered this child abuse material in the aftermath of the August shooting as they scoured Freeman's devices, but that nothing was sort of revealed in the hearing about this.
Yep. Okay. We've got, you know, witnesses to come later. Do we have any idea who we might hear from as this inquest progresses?
So there was no official witness list spoken about during the hearing, but we would expect that we will hear from forensic experts from Victoria Police. We know that Freeman's wife, Amalia, was represented by lawyers during that hearing, and also family members of the deceased may well also give evidence as well during that hearing.
Okay, yeah. And, I mean, this isn't a kind of a short turnaround kind of vibe. The next hearing or the hearings for this inquest was set down for March next year. Is that the full inquest? Is that when we'll kind of dive into this proper?
Yeah, that's right. So it was a tentative date that was set, so it's not locked in. By not locking in, they really have a bit of flexibility given the amount of evidence that will have to be gathered for this full coronial inquest. But it is likely that it will be early next year that we do hear the full inquest.
Okay, Ash. Yeah, a little bit of time to go. But, I mean, we spoke about the community and how the community was feeling in our episode on Tuesday. How's the police feeling? How are the family and friends of these officers coping at this stage with this process just kicking off?
Yeah, so it's for the community. They were really ready to move on. They wanted to sort of distance themselves from these shootings. But for the family and friends, particularly the friends of Detective Thompson, who I've spent a lot of time with over the past few months, they say this won't bring him back, but it will provide some closure. It's particularly hard for them when something happens, an arrest is made or an inquest is on, that it sort of all gets brought up again. So they are really looking forward to things coming to an end finally. One of his friends sort of said to me that hopefully Neil will finally be able to rest in peace at the end of this, because it hasn't felt like it has been able to while Freeman was still on the run, while arrests haven't been made or while an inquest is still ongoing.
Yeah, absolutely. Ash, thanks so much for joining us for, you know, these episodes this week, for, you know, helping break down what happened at the coronial inquest direction hearings, the whole start of this process for these two inquiries, and also for kind of taking us to the northeast of Victoria and giving us an understanding of, you know, what it was like when all of this unfolded and that local knowledge that you've brought us over these last couple of episodes.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you missed the first episode of this story, the episode that Ash and I did on the coronial inquiry into Desi Freeman's death, you should check that out in the Case of feed. You can grab ABC Listen for that and a heap of other wonderful podcasts. Also, tell your friends, share this, help them understand what happened on these days. Also, you might have seen some reporting that Victorian courts are preparing to consider Erin Patterson's appeal of her triple murder conviction. The court hasn't confirmed a date or anything yet, but we will keep a close eye on that for you. If you are looking for some background, we popped the episode we did in November last year when we got the appeal documents. In that, Christian Silver breaks down the grounds that Erin Patterson is appealing on. Questions about the phone tower evidence, about the claim that her cross-examination was unfair, among several others, might be worth another listen to that episode if you're up for a refresher or you want to sound read in at your parties this weekend. Be back in your feed on Tuesday. The Case Of is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. This episode was reported by Ashley Aldridge and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims, our legal queen, for her legal advice, to ABC Goulburn Murray and to Audio Studios manager Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Wiradjuri and Wurundjeri people.